The Federal Drive with Tom Temin, sponsored by GEHA.
Hello, and thanks for joining us on this Thursday, April 25th, 2024, 7 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Temin. Our producers are Eric White and Peter Masurlian. Our digital editors, Daisy Thornton, Michelle Sandiford, and Darius Lauderdale. Coming up in this hour of The Federal Drive, contractor associations are okay with new OMB memo on artificial intelligence. Plus, the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency ups the S-bomb game. Those stories and much more ahead during this hour of The Federal Drive. But first, navigating budget limitations, staff retention, and how to keep employees engaged makes human resources people like Sisyphus rolling that stone uphill. Plus, they've got to deal with newfangled initiatives like skills-based and early career hiring. One agency is getting the hang of recruitment and retention. Federal News Network's Drew Friedman got the story from the acting chief human capital officer at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, Eric Dilworth.
One of the first things we have to focus on, are along with hiring new employees, whether to fill positions within the human capital office. You know, we need as many folks in operation area staffing, operational area, because we weren't filling a lot of jobs externally anyway. So we need to get the right HR skills within Otico. So we've been concentrating on that for the last couple of years. And that is, we're here in the capital region, and it's really competitive. Finding seasoned HR folks is competitive with all the agencies. So we're bringing on many new people. And you talk about retention. One of the main things about retention is continue to provide experience building opportunities for our current employees, and also training. So we've been really, identifying a lot of rotational opportunities where employees can go get other experiences that, can enhance their career and just, enhance their interests at remaining at NRC. And then training, making sure we're providing the right training for people to be proficient at their jobs. And then also leadership training that, give people, those folks who do want to move into the leadership realm, give them the right skills to do that. So, it's outreach, it's taking care of our current employees, and getting the right skills to meet the mission.
You bring up a lot of really interesting points there, and things that I definitely have heard from other agencies, talking about recruiting for HR positions at the same time that you're trying to bring in other skills. And, I guess I want to ask you about the retention aspect of it, if we could dive a little bit deeper there. You mentioned training for employees, rotational opportunities. How often do you see employees taking advantage of those types of flexibilities? And are there other things that you notice make people want to stay with the agency for the long haul?
Talking about the training first, we do training surveys where employees can identify the type of training they would like, whether it's, skills training for their current career field, or if it's some other kind of type of training that would disenhance them as an overall federal employee. So we have a good budget for that. So that's the way we really, and also with leadership identifying critical training needs. And that's, we have a technical training center that does all of our, different training for the nuclear experts in our career field, and bring them there to, that basically enhance their job qualifications to perform their work. But retention goes, our retention numbers are equal or a little bit less than the average for federal agencies. But with that, if you see anyone leaving, and it seems to be a trend, you want to retain as much talent you can in the agency. So that's really gets down to the culture of an agency. That, I find that people remain at an agency or an organization because, they enjoy the work, first of all, but But then they also, in the culture of that organization, some a culture that makes people want to say they feel valued. They feel like their work is valued. So we have, it's not in Ochico, but the agency has a culture team and a culture, a lead for that, that's been doing a lot of work on that in the last year. And that's where we hope to see, you know, continued increased retention of NRC employees.
And when you're looking at something like culture, how do you measure that? Are there different surveys or different ways that you ask employees how they feel about the work setting? And, you know, what are some of the data points that you look at for that?
Yeah. And I want to first say I'm not the expert in culture, but we do, as a leader, we all use the FAB survey. That's a starting point. And then, you know, feedback from your members of your organization. And the culture team, I think they are, you know, putting together additional surveys. But, you know, you do start with the FAB survey and then this interaction with the workforce to understand challenges and barriers to whether it's job satisfaction or other issues that they could be dealing with.
You touched on this a little bit already, but were there specific factors of FEVs that you're looking at this year to try to improve?
There are, I think, employee engagement, communication are always, you know, high on that list, because, you know, the better we communicate, whether it's communicating changes in an organization, communicating, you know, what's going on with the organization, different initiatives, and ensuring that information is available to the workforce. That's one of the challenges, to make sure you do that consistently and at a high level. And workload management is always an issue. So from a Chico point of view, the better we can do at training people, providing training, better we can do it filling vacancies in a timely manner, that helps with the overall culture, because people know the jobs are filled, we fill them with the right skill sets. That helps everyone to be able to execute their job better and for everyone to be successful.
I want to talk a little bit more about recruitment as well. So you mentioned earlier on, just a few minutes ago, that you guys go to college campuses. So is early career hiring a priority for NRC? And can you talk a little bit about some of the strategies that you have specifically for recruiting those just at the start of their career?
Yes. I mean, that is always having early career people on board to be trained and get the experience as they go through and be able to replace, you know, our knowledge folks that are eventually going to retire, you know. So having that type of program in place is key. One such program that we have is our NREN program, Nuclear Regulator Apprenticeship Network. We bring in about 25 entry level, mostly engineers, in over about an 18 months, 2 years. And we keep this program going continuously. They're trained, they go out on rotational assignments to the different regions. So after their 2 years, they have gained a lot of experience, and then they're placed in a permanent position throughout the agency. It could be at headquarters, or it could be at one of the four regions. So that's one unique program that we have. On top of that, we have a big summer hire program. And then from that, many of those students are then may go into co-op positions and that type of thing.
One other priority that the administration has had for a couple of years, even going back to the previous administration, has been on skills-based hiring. Is that something that comes into play, whether that's in conjunction with early career hiring or something that NRC is trying to do more broadly?
I think that's something that you focus on all the time, because you can't just base the hiring on certain degrees. or just certain experience. And with a lot of our positions, it's a combination, though, having certain degree requirements as far as that's what's needed to perform the duties of the jobs, but also what skills do we need, you know, the background we need. So we do skills hiring. No, that's where we target maybe certain conferences that we go and recruit at, because those skill sets are at that conference, or certain colleges that we target. But we try to, you know, whether it's historically Black colleges and universities, all universities across the nation, as much as we can. You know, you don't have a budget to do everything you want to do, but we do get out to all types of universities. But based on, do they have the type of skills and degrees that we're targeting? We can always get better at it, but we do strategic workforce planning where we identify our critical skills, and that's what we try to tie our recruitment to. And, you know, of course, that's a lot of the engineers, whether people will be resident inspectors out at the different nuclear sites, whether it's people working program and policy issues, but they need a nuclear background. All of those things we know. I consider that, you know, skills targeted recruitment.
As you mentioned earlier as well, is HR part of that mix as well for trying to focus on specific skills?
We are. I mean, you know, not just finding people who can be what we call staffing specialists, where they do the recruitment and processing those actions, issuing hiring certificates. But depending, you know, we have the wide gamut of, you know, HR skills needed in our organization, from HR analysts who, you know, do a lot of analytics for us, our training experts, our policy people, labor who does the union negotiation. So it's you know, we target all of those depending on the need, and we have a need in a lot of those areas. The other thing we're, you know, starting to look at is for our own career field, for, you know, human resources, you know, building that bench, you know, having HR trainees per se, where we're building the bench. That's something we haven't done a lot of in this office, but that's something we're looking at moving to.
What are the types of trainings that either employees are most looking for, or that NRC is most seeking to try to build skills?
It really depends on your job. If you're a regulator or inspector out there at the different locations, you know, we have simulators, so that those simulators, they go through that training where they become familiar with what they would be looking at on a day-to-day basis when they're back, you know, at their site. But the other training, you know, it goes to full realm. It could be something that it could be a policy person, and by going to a certain specific training, it's going to help them better understand the type of regulations they're working with, have that insight. And currency is another thing, being current with what's going on in the nuclear field. So it's really a wide gamut. But as I said before, a lot of the ways we obtain what people are looking for us through our, you know, we do it twice a year, our external training survey, where people can identify the type of training. Not everything fits, you know, it needs to be job related or some enhancement to to employees' federal career. So we try to, you know, balance that, where, you know, we ensure that, you know, people are getting the training so that they're qualified and to do their job, but also there's other career development opportunities and training that folks are looking for.
And just one other aspect of whether it's recruitment or retention that I definitely want to touch on is this idea of hybrid work and the hybrid workforce. I know there's been a lot of shifts lately with agencies in terms of teleworking or working in person, but how does hybrid work and those types of flexibilities affect recruitment and retention? Is that something that you consider when you're looking at building out some of these long-term strategies?
We do have a hybrid work work environment, some telework, and then in office requirement also. So it's really about educating the potential applicants on what our hybrid workforce is. We still value interaction of the workforce. The most thing is, are we completing the mission with this hybrid workforce? And I say we are highly productive. We have a very dedicated workforce. Folks want to do a great job, want to succeed, but also want to see the agency succeed. So, the hybrid workforce, I see it as a positive and has been a positive for NRC. And it's a balance of everything out there with the different federal agencies. But we believe that, our hybrid workforce works. We're executing the mission, and we're able to recruit people to come into this environment.
Eric Dilworth, Acting Chief Human Capital Officer at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, speaking with Federal News Network's Drew Friedman. Check out Drew's story at federalnewsnetwork.com. Still to come, the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency ups the SBOM game. This is the Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. Welcome back to the Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Network. Software bills of material. Everyone knows that somehow they're crucial to cybersecurity. But deciphering these documents, known in the vernacular as SBOMs, has been a challenge for many agencies. The Silicon Valley Innovation Program aims to help. It's part of the Homeland Security Science and Technology Directorate, and it has a program to promote development of what it calls supply chain visibility tools. Joining me with the details, the managing director of the Silicon Valley Innovation Program, Melissa Oh. Ms. Oh, good to have you with us.
Thanks, Tom. Good to be here.
And we also have its technical director, Anil John. Mr. John, good to have you back.
Thank you.
Well, tell us what's going on here. Maybe a little bit of background on the Silicon Valley Innovation Program, and then we'll get into what you're doing to help agencies with this SBOM conundrum. I guess you have to read SBOMs and nobody knows how to do it.
That's right. Well, thanks, Tom. Really glad to be here. And the Silicon Valley Innovation Program within the Department of Homeland Security's Science and Technology Directorate is focused on working with the startup community and identifying problems that they can help us solve by baking in some of the pain points that DHS has into the commercial products that they're developing. And so by leveraging the other transaction authority, we're able to more quickly reach the startup community and get them under contract quite quickly and get them working on some of our hard problems within DHS.
Yeah, Anil, tell us about SBOMs, because it sounds like a great idea. Read the ingredients and you know what's in your software. But in fact, these are complex documents. There could be thousands of components in a given software program. And there are competing, standard languages for expressing SBOMs. Fair to say?
Very fair to say. I'll start with the last piece first. There's a very famous cartoon that is out there that is prevalent in the standards community where there are competing standards. And then somebody else comes in and says, hey, we need to have one standard that sort of unifies all of them. And now we have three competing standards. So I want to start out by saying that what we want to do here is not that. We do not want to create a new standard. There are actually two very mature standards in the SBOM space called Cyclone DX and SPDX that targets different communities, but are both considered SBOM standards. And as you noted, Tom, SBOMs are very similar to the nutrition labels on food. It provides an indicator of what goes into software and identifies potentially things that are vulnerable that you need to be updated. And we want to sort of ensure the interoperability and the broad acceptability of that through our work here.
Yes, they're like food labels, except it would be a food that has 10,000 ingredients in some cases.
More in some cases, open source components, closed source components, and a variety of other things pulled from a variety of places. So that is exactly why we need visibility into the, for lack of a better word, the supply chain of software before it is deployed within a government network.
Sure. Those ingredients, there's more in software than there is in, say, Doritos, So it's a really a long list. And Ms. O, then these companies, what will they be doing? What are you seeking from these companies in this effort to organize the reading of SBOMs?
As Anil set up, the need for the ability to translate between these two standards is important in order to ensure the broader adoption of SBOMs across enterprises and other organizations. And so our cohort of startups developed actually an SBOM translation tool called ProtoBOM, which has now been launched and is now openly available through the open source community at OpenSSF through the Linux Foundation. So we're really excited. They announced that just last week at Open Source Summit, and it's available for everyone to start to adopt.
We are speaking with Melissa Oh. She is Managing Director of the Silicon Valley Innovation Program, and also Anil John, Technical Director of that program at the Homeland Security Science and Technology Directorate. And is the overall goal then to maybe abstract for a given agency practitioner the SBOM, which is this big document, and such that they can apply some of these new products that you're having developed to an SBOM and figure out what the SBOM is telling them, because maybe there's only 10% of it that might be of concern in a given package?
I think that is spot on. It's more along the lines of agencies or organizations or even tool builders should not need to worry about the format and the standards that are being used for SBOM. But if by using the ProtoBOM that Melissa mentioned, they have the ability to sort of, you know, automatically translate that and sort of ingest it without having to worry about all of that. And to your point there, the projects that we are funding, the ProtoBOM piece is an artifact that is going to be baked into all of the capabilities that we are funding. For example, like visualizing SBOMs, the ability to sort of visualize software right within the SDE, right within SIEM products, and show connectivity to like vulnerabilities and things like that. That's the high level piece that is really important, because SBOMs by themselves just show you what is in there, but it doesn't directly tell you if something is vulnerable or not. So the products that we're building and having our companies build are actually doing that connectivity, and ProtoBOM abstracts and sort of makes the translation war go away or the format war go away.
And it sounds like it does this in a situation that is context sensitive. That is, if you're in your SIEM program, you need one view. And if you're maybe, I don't know, in acceptance or runtime type of situation, then you need another view.
That is absolutely correct. You know, we fully realize that obviously different entities within an enterprise need to look at this, whether it is a developer that is building software, having it directly visible within their software IDE, whether it is a system administrator, having it visible across the enterprise, and somebody who's sort of looking in a software in general and what the assets that they have, having the ability to visualize that as well. So all of those capabilities are something that are being built out by the cohort of companies that we are funding. And underneath the covers, all of them are also baking in the ProtoBOM translation software into their products, such that basically they don't have to worry about the format that the SBOM comes in.
Right. And by the way, ProtoBOM only has one B in it, correct?
That is correct.
Make sure we get that spelling right. And Melissa, tell us about the programmatic aspects of this. You have multiple vendors involved in the ProtoBOM effort. How do they get along, and what's the intellectual property sharing piece of all of this from, you know, again, the project standpoint?
So as far as the companies are concerned, they're working collaboratively together as a cohort. Their IP is their IP. They're contributing to the open source. They're developing their own products and tools and solutions independently, but because they're pulling in ProtoBOM, they work collaboratively together. And so they're doing great. They just finished phase one. They're all entering phase two. And by the end of phase four, they'll have solutions that are completely commercialized and available for acquisition by government organizations or commercial enterprises. Many of them are actually commercializing their existing product suites now. And by the end of phase four, they'll have fully functioning commercial capabilities.
And it sounds like the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, CISA, one of your maybe partner components at DHS, could be a channel for getting this in front of individual agencies, since they do that with so many other types of cyber concerns.
Absolutely. CISA is our partner in this project, and they've been advocating for the work that we're doing with the companies as well. And so we're working very closely with Alan Friedman, who I'm sure has been on the pod before. He's definitely a great advocate for what we're doing here.
And what is delivered is a usable product, a application that is already compiled and has an interface, and people can say, shove their S-bombs in and get some wisdom out of them. Anil?
I think, you know, the model of SVIP is absolutely that. At the end of the phase four, there should be a product SKU that is available in the market that agencies can buy and the broader community can buy. In this particular case, obviously, there are two tiers to that, right? So there is the products themselves that the companies will have that basically may be add-ons to software IDEs, may be add-ons to SIEM products, may be add-ons to visualization software that people can actually acquire and buy. And obviously the piece that is fully documented, open source, available under a license that both open source as well as closed source companies can leverage is the protobomb, which has now been accepted into the OpenSSF, which is a pretty big deal because then you got, you know, global eyes on it, maintainers that are going to be supporting it, contributing and the like, that is going to have a life of its own and maintained, you know, going forward as well.
In other words, the protobomb is kind of like the engine about which people can build all different types of vehicles.
I think it's too much to say that it is an engine. I think it is definitely a critical part of an engine that basically, you know, provides the entire capability more than anything else. And the critical part it's providing is basically not having to worry about the different formats of S-bombs that are out there.
Right. So the final question to you, Ms. Oh, is the demand signal from agencies, both in DHS and maybe around the government, that great, we're getting S-bombs, but it's like somebody dumping a load of hay on us, and it's really hard to rationalize what it is that's in front of us, this big pile.
That's right. I do think that by having these capabilities, the executive order that was put out will make it much more simple to be able to achieve some of the requirements that are out there in terms of cybersecurity and software supply chain visibility.
Melissa Oh is Managing Director of the Silicon Valley Innovation Program. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Anil John is Technical Director of the Silicon Valley Innovation Project. Great to have you with us.
Absolutely. Great to be here. Thank you.
And both at the Homeland Security Science and Technology Directorate. And they'll be demoing the protobomb and related products during the week of May 21st in Alexandria, Virginia. We'll post this interview along with a link to more information at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Subscribe to the Federal Drive wherever you get your podcasts. Still to come, FEMA's cloud computing marathon is about to hit a long uphill. But first, contractor associations, they're okay with new OMB memos on artificial intelligence. This is the Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. Welcome back to the Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Network. The trade associations connected to federal technology generally back the latest White House directives on artificial intelligence. A recent Office of Management and Budget memo gives agencies detailed guidance on making trustworthy and secure AI systems. For one view, we turn to the Executive Vice President for Policy at the Information Technology Industry Council, Gordon Bitko. Gordon, good to have you back.
Tom, great to be here as always.
And when you were a federal CIO, this whole artificial intelligence question really didn't come up. I mean, people knew it was out there, but it wasn't really something close to the toolbox for CIOs, was it?
It was not. I think what we've had is a real tipping point in computational ability that's made it much more available and accessible much more widely and readily today than it was. But as you know, Tom, the reality is a lot of what we're saying is AI now are things that we did talk about 4 or 5 years ago when I was in the government. A lot of the advanced machine learning capabilities, a lot of those tools were there already.
And the White House memos in the Biden administration have been lengthy and detailed, but there's a lot of detail that needs to be in there. Is there anything in ITI's view or in your experience that's fundamentally different about AI and how to build AI systems than any other kind of logic-based application using software?
That's a great question, Tom. To your initial point, there is an awful lot of specificity in the executive order, in the OMB guidance memo, beyond what I would say is the normal sort of guidance that would come out on a technology issue coming from the White House to agencies. The reality is that I think a lot of this is about the perceptions of risk associated with the use cases of AI that people have talked about and the fear about where the system's going to go and how reliable and how accurate are they. But the reality is, if you look at a lot of what the memo, the guidance to agencies expects out of this new role, the chief AI officer, it's no different than what chief information officers are supposed to be doing for agencies already. What's the inventory of all the technology you have? How is it being used? How are you managing the risks? How are you ensuring you have the right resources in place and prioritizing things? Those are all things that a CIO is supposed to be doing today.
And it sounds like in the case of AI, though, it's not strictly a CIO concern, because the rise of the data officer, which is somewhat separate from the CIO, in some cases it's not even in the CIO channel, that varies from agency to agency, but the data issue is a big part of AI, because the data goes into the AI as opposed to the other traditional applications where they produce the data.
That's a great point, Tom. A couple of observations on that. One is, I think it's going to be confusing for agencies. They've got a chief data officer now, a chief AI officer, a chief privacy officer who's got responsibilities around a lot of these data concerns, a chief information officer, a chief information security officer, maybe a chief technology officer. And as you noted, sometimes they're co-located organizationally, sometimes they're not. Sometimes their priorities are well aligned with the overall mission. Sometimes they have different priorities because they report to different parts of the organization. That's going to be a really big challenge for agencies to figure out, number one. Number two, the point about the importance of data is absolutely critical here. Agencies have been slowly coming around to the importance of that for quite a while and making investments, but that's lagged. That's one of the reasons why I would hope that this will give the impetus to agencies to make investments that they need. There is a federal data strategy. They've been slowly working towards it, but it hasn't gotten the attention that it really should. And maybe this is a way to move that forward.
And maybe the memo didn't state this explicitly, but in some ways it kind of reflects the age-old idea that ultimately it's the program and the program manager, program owner, business line owner that's ultimately responsible for what happens in that program, including the IT and whatever effects AI would have. Fair to say?
Absolutely. I think for the AI officers to be effective, they're going to have to be in this in-between space between the technologists, between the CIO, the CTO, the security, and the mission, the business people, and understanding that big picture for the AI use case. What is the mission? Why is this AI tool, data system going to help solve a problem for the agency in ways that we couldn't previously? They're going to have to serve in that bridge. And if they don't develop that understanding and expertise of the mission, they can't be successful.
We're speaking with Gordon Bitko, Executive Vice President of Policy at the Information Technology Industry Council. And then, of course, whatever agencies must do means contractors and companies are going to have to do it. And that's where it kind of runs downhill to the companies. What's your best advice for all of the integrators, the developers, the application providers, the cloud people that are going to be impacted because AI is so much in demand?
Well, the first thing I would say is that there is a recognition of that on the side of government. There is an RFI specifically looking about how do we do responsible procurement of AI for government needs. My hope is that the government realizes that the most responsible procurement that they can do is to work closely with industry, with the whole ecosystem you just mentioned, to say, we want to do this in a secure, reliable way, but using commercial best practices. Far too often, as we've talked about in the past, Tom, the government comes up with a long list of requirements for, I think, good reasons, but what you end up with then is building some custom one-off solution that's hard to maintain, hard to support, hard to modernize, and eventually you end up with a 20-year-old system that nobody really knows what to do with it anymore. I would really hate to see that happen in the case of AI. At the pace the technology is moving, the best thing that government industry can do is work together to get solutions in the hands of the people who need it.
It seems like a contractor that's going to be dealing with algorithms and delivering them almost has to have into its basic operating plan as a company the controls needed for AI, rather than try to make a bespoke AI safety solution, let's put it, for each and every contract or task order.
That's right. We would really like to see, for example, the NIST AI risk management framework and guidance built around that be adopted broadly. And then government agencies can have confidence that the contractors that they're working with understand risk, understand the use cases for their technology, and are putting in place the things necessary to ensure that it's being done safely and securely, that the data that's being used to train the system are representative, that they're not biased. All those valid concerns, there are ways to follow them. One of the areas where I think the OMB memo goes a little bit astray is, instead of saying follow that approach, they come out with a laundry list of here's all the things that they think are high risk.
Sure.
Undoubtedly, many of them are high risk, but the specifics of every use case are going to vary. And we would really rather say, let's use the risk management framework rather than have this other sort of prescriptive approach.
And can you envision a time when companies won't really be selling AI, just as agencies won't be buying AI? They'll simply be buying and selling contemporary applications, a component of which happens to be artificial intelligence.
That's already happening today, Tom. It's a great point. And one of the questions that we've had and one of the challenges, to give you an example, we have in the ITI membership a number of companies who provide security solutions in one way or another. A lot of the way that they build their models to understand security threats is using big data, machine learning, AI models that collect millions or billions of endpoint pieces of data about what are the threats and what are the activity, and they need sophisticated tools to help them understand, is this an indicator of a threat or not? And then they provide the results of that to the government, to customers who are using those products and services. That's going to happen more and more across the board, where people are going to want those capabilities. They're going to want that because the amount of data is too large otherwise to deal with. It's not the sort of thing that you can solve in other ways.
Sure. And just a final question on the talent base in industry and government. Is it sufficient to cover these needs so that everyone can act in a competent manner and still fulfill what OMB wants? And really what OMB wants is basic good practice and good hygiene for anyone using AI.
I think that's what they would call a leading question, right, Tom? We know when it comes to technology that there is never enough trained, skilled workforce across the board. There are individual agencies that are more technically inclined, that are operating from a higher starting point and probably in pretty good shape. But across the board, we need to invest in joint solutions between government and industry, between public and private partnerships, to raise the overall skill level. And then I think a related point to that, Tom, is lots of job descriptions over time in the government and outside are going to evolve because people are going to want and need to take advantage of new tools. And so what does that mean? And what does that mean for retraining the existing workforce so that they know how to use those tools and become more effective and be more focused on the actual real things that we need them to do that can't be solved by AI, but really actually do need a person to be looking at something and making a decision.
Gordon Bitko is Executive Vice President of Policy at the Information Technology Industry Council, the ITI. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks again, Tom. Great to be with you.
And we'll post this interview along with a link to more information at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Subscribe to the Federal Drive wherever you get your podcasts. Still to come, FEMA's cloud computing marathon is about to hit a long uphill. This is the Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. Welcome back to the Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Network. The Federal Emergency Management Agency has about 60% of its computing workloads in the cloud. Now the hard work begins. For how FEMA is pushing to close more of its data centers and do more in the cloud, Federal News Network's Jason Miller spoke to FEMA Chief Information Officer Charlie Armstrong.
Now, of course, the work gets a little bit more difficult because, you know, as the engineering and the technical pieces get harder, that may slow down our velocity a little bit. But the goal is to get everything migrated out of that center so that we can start to decommission it and shut it down. So that's kind of the primary work stream that we have going on. In addition to that, in the September-October timeframe, we kicked off a small rehosting effort that's actually pulling the covers back on some of these systems that are not planned to be modernized for a while, and maybe doing some database replatforming, making them ready to be what we call cloud native so that we can really leverage the value of cloud and be able to scale up and scale down as we need to. And then we've got a few, as I said, programs that still have some data in data centers outside of our current FEMA data center. They're also planning on migrating to cloud over the coming year. So that's what we've got going forward.
Charlie, we're hitting up against the break. Before we do that, first of all, congratulations on the full operating capability for the grants management and the FEMA Go. I imagine that has been a years-long effort and a huge lift, and it's going to make a big difference to both people working inside FEMA, but more importantly, citizens who use those tools. Just real quick, I mean, hope you had some cake. Hope you celebrated a little bit.
Well, you know, that was Alana Barnhart and her team, and hats off to them. A big shout out to them. So, yeah, I know that they did some celebrating when they hit their milestone. Of course, as I said, they've got a lot more work to do in terms of starting to transition data and actually move grant types over. So more work is on their plate. They've got a really talented crew there. So hats off to them. I've really been just kind of the big cheerleader in making sure that they get what they need out of our organization to get their job done.
By the end of March, you hit about 60% of all applications were migrated out of your current data center into various cloud service providers. That's a great start over the last year or so. Then you also mentioned back in the fall, you kicked off a rehosting effort, pulling kind of the covers back on some of those other applications that need to be replatformed. Let's start with the 60% of applications. How big of a lift was that? And how do you get that other 40%?
We got off to what I would call a slow start. And mainly that was the complexity around the networking between our existing data center and our connections into the CSPs that we're using. So it took us some time to kind of make sure that we had the latency issues worked out so that we had the performance that was required in order to keep those as viable applications. And of course, we started with development and test because of not wanting to get the mission critical operational applications in a risky situation. And so, you know, we started to build some velocity up last spring. And as we continued to work out and work through some of the technology challenges, we hit about 25% of, and I say applications, it was really workloads, which we measure by virtual machines. We were able to hit that milestone by the end of the fiscal year in September. And then the velocities continue to improve since then. And we've gotten up to the 60%. We are definitely challenged by the fact that we are using Oracle Rack, and we're trying to move applications into primarily Azure. And so we went back and forth and finally decided to use OCI for our database platforms. And so we're starting to move those rack workloads into OCI now. So when you talk about how do you get the remaining 40%, that's how we're planning on meeting that challenge. Now, I don't know that we're going to hit 100% by the end of the calendar year. As I saw from my other agencies that I've been at, you know, getting to that 60 to 70% seems to be the easier part, but getting that last 20 to 25% always poses some challenges because you get to things that are just difficult to pick up and move, and you almost have to modernize your way off. So we do have, like I said, a number of modernization programs going on. I mentioned grants management. We also have a financial systems modernization being led out of DHS headquarters. So that'll occur over time. And so while we're migrating our legacy financial system to cloud, the goal will be eventually to turn that off and go to the new system. So taking that kind of approach will help us over time. So that's how we're kind of working our way through it.
When you look at those metrics, again, you know, not holding you to the 80% or what is really some of those goals around, hey, if we could close down or reduce, consolidate the data centers and move more applications to the cloud, what would get you all in a point where, I don't know, Charlie, satisfaction, the best word, would you be satisfied at a certain point?
I think getting some of our critical, what I call customer-facing applications into cloud would really hit the mark, right? So there are some things that, you know, whether we get moved to cloud or not in the next year, probably won't make a big shift in customer satisfaction and or our ability to hit mission. But if you look at areas like individual assistance, which is a very much customer facing application, you know, because they're providing assistance to that survivor at the point in time of a disaster, the ability to scale up and meet a surge capacity. You know, if you think of some of the major incidents that have happened over the years, like Katrina and Sandy and so forth, you know, we always try to plan for, or I should say the agency has tried to plan for the worst day, and having a cloud CSP really provides a lot more room for surge capacity. So when we talk about year of resilience, cloud is a key part of that, because being able to surge up, being able to leverage different types of SaaS services through the cloud that we may need to opt into on the fly in order to meet a special demand. All those are really reasons as to why we're so adamant on getting to cloud. I don't anticipate that there's going to be some huge cost savings at the end of the day. We do get to avoid some recapitalization of the equipment that's in the facility today. And the way I see it, we're going to get to more resilient data centers and be able to do things like geographic diversity and have multiple points of entry through the departmental's new CAP programs.
Charlie Armstrong is Chief Information Officer at FEMA, speaking with Federal News Network's Jason Miller. Find more episodes of Ask the CIO at federalnewsnetwork.com. It's a classic story. New technology becomes widely available to consumers. The government falls behind from lagging policy and plain old inertia. Well, now the National Institute of Standards and Technology is trying to buck that trend with the latest update to its digital identity guidelines. The new guidance could help agencies adopt stronger forms of multi-factor authentication. Federal News Network's Justin Doubleday joins me with the latest. And what is in this new digital identity guidance from NIST, Justin?
Yeah, this supplement, as NIST is calling it, to the digital identity guidance offers some guidelines for incorporating syncable authenticators. Now, these are more commonly known as passkeys. They can sync across multiple different devices. A good example is Apple's Face ID. The FIDO Alliance, which is an industry group that sets open standards for passkeys, says these are a major way to get away from relying on passwords, which of course are difficult to remember and increasingly easy to hack. So the NIST update is actually the first supplement it's issued for these guidelines. Typically, the agency takes years to issue a wholesale revision to these publications rather than issuing these small updates. But Ryan Galuso, the digital identity program lead at NIST, says the supplement comes after a lot of people submitted comments about the lack of support for these synced passkeys.
So agencies are expected to offer phishing-resistant authentication to individuals coming to use their services online. Now, there's not a ton of ways to do that without things like hardware security keys and being able to kind of distribute those. We've realized we can come up with a set of requirements that can allow agencies to make use of this technology right now in a way that will help particularly the public in being able to improve the way they authenticate to online services.
Yeah, it almost reminds me of the early days of the web when federal agencies weren't allowed to keep cookies about people, you know, and so forth, and that limited their utility. So why were the use of synced passkeys, we should say it's S-Y-N-C, not sync, like sinking a ship, why were these off limits to begin with under the NIST guidance?
Yeah, so the synced passkeys are relatively new. These are things that sync across multiple devices. They started becoming widely available just a couple of years ago, around 2022. And the last version of NIST's digital identity guidelines came out in 2017. And a strict reading of those guidelines would prevent agencies from using synced passkeys because it bars them from using cryptographic device authenticators that can be exported to multiple devices. That's the way these synced passkeys work. If you look at the NIST guidance, agencies are required to follow it and see that line in there, then you're going to think, well, we can't really use or offer the public the ability to use these different passkeys to authenticate into our services. So the idea here with this supplement is that agencies can now read this if they were thinking about it, but saying, hey, the NIST guidance doesn't allow us to use it. Now it does.
And when agencies get this guidance, what do they have to do to utilize it?
Well, they're not required necessarily to do anything. NIST guidance isn't directive, but it is the standard that agencies follow. But there's two main use cases that agencies are thinking about here. There's the public-facing use cases that Brian Galuso from NIST referenced, and then there's the enterprise use cases. So the federal zero trust strategy directs agencies to offer phishing-resistant multi-factor authentication for public-facing services. And so that's where these synced passkeys could be used potentially almost immediately by agencies. As for the enterprise side, how agencies, you know, authenticate their actual employees and contractors to access their internal networks, there are probably a few extra steps that agencies have to go through to make sure that they can use these passkeys securely. Galuso says NIST is actually working with the FIDO Alliance on some of those to help answer some of those big questions.
How do you make sure you've got the policy enforcement capability on devices to prevent things like sharing from one device that is enterprise managed to a device that isn't enterprise managed? All right, so making sure that we've got a standard set of requirements and expectations and ideally implementation paths that agencies can understand, all right, if I'm going to use these, what do I need to put in place? What do we need to potentially procure? What kind of features do I need to have with like my mobile device management? They're almost there. I think we need to kind of address some of those gaps, but I think they're pretty close on the enterprise side.
Almost there, pretty close. When do they actually expect to come out with this revision for the digital identities?
Yeah, the broader revision to the guidelines, Galuso told me he hopes to have that update out by the end of the year. These comments come from actually Okta's conference that happened in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday. So that's why there's so much conversation about digital identity, naturally. This NIST update will include the supplement on passkeys. It will also address a lot of other questions around identity, the use of things like biometrics and facial recognition, as well as AI, and how perhaps organizations can address things like deepfakes that are becoming a bigger and bigger issue.
And meanwhile, while we're on the topic of identities, NIST is also doing some work on mobile driver's licenses, which seems a decade overdue. What's the latest there, Justin?
Yeah, more states are rolling out these mobile driver's licenses, MDLs. They can be stored in a smartphone wallet. TSA has been at the forefront of actually adopting these and allowing for their use at some limited amount of airports around the country. Now, NIST's digital identity team is working internally with the agency's National Cybersecurity Center of Excellence on how people can use mobile driver's licenses online to authenticate and verify their identity for different use cases. Galuso says NIST is working with the international standards community to better define the actual technical standards around the mobile driver's license itself. And then importantly, NIST is working with technology groups to understand how standard APIs could allow for the use of these MDLs across different applications, whether that's a federal agency online service or otherwise. So Galuso says NIST is really working through all of those issues right now on the technical and design side of MDLs.
Is it ready for prime time? Probably not quite, but it is getting there. And, you know, one of our goals is to be able to, within our digital identity guidelines, make sure it's prepared for that future. So we are allowing for the acceptance of mobile driver's license and then simultaneously working on the application side to make sure that we bring the actual ability to use them online.
Well, anything that makes a thinner wallet is welcome in my view. I don't like fat wallets, so let's hope they get that one out pretty soon.
Yeah, I think it. Everyone's putting their cards in the back of their phones now, so why not just put the actual digital card within your phone, right?
Fair enough. Federal News Network's Justin Doubleday, thanks so much.
All right, thanks, Tom.
And be sure to check out his story at federalnewsnetwork.com. This is the Federal Drive with Tom Temin. For the latest updates, stay with federalnewsnetwork.com or follow us on Facebook and LinkedIn. I'm Tom Temin.